This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Well, thank you very much, Roger, and good morning from WGN West in Scottsdale, Arizona this morning. No snow falling, but it's cool for the desert, according to the natives. 49 degrees here this morning, but a lot of sunshine and no snow. Of course, we are heading into the first of several holiday shortened trading weeks. The Thanksgiving week with markets closed on Thursday in observance of Thanksgiving Day, and markets closing early on Friday, closing at 12 noon. We'll talk more about that later. But this morning, we'll talk markets. Max Armstrong will visit with Jim McCormick of Allendale. And Steve Alexander will be joining us in a moment or so to talk to Scott Irwin about year-round E15. And then I'll be talking apples with Jim Baer, who is the president and CEO of the U.S. Apple Association. So we have a lot to do between now and 6 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show, and we enjoy your company and thank you for coming along. We'll get to our first report with Steve and his guest when we continue here on the Saturday morning show. Well, now that the excitement has died down just a bit following the president's announcement a couple of months ago that he wants corn-based E15 fuel to be available year-round, people who look at the science of E15 say there are some barriers to year-round E15. An ag economist from the University of Illinois talked with our Steve Alexander about some of those barriers.
Orion, I spoke to Scott Irwin, a professor of agricultural economics at the University of Illinois, and while politicians in farm states and various farm organizations are calling the president's mandate for year-round E15 a big win for biofuels and for corn farmers, Professor Irwin, who, as an economist, looks only at the numbers, not emotions, is not on board.
Well, I am skeptical, not because I'm innately opposed to E15. I'm just trying to evaluate the economic merits and how that will impact what's actually going to happen in the marketplace rather than politics.
Let's go right to the bottom line for Midwest corn farmers, and that is, what impact will this announcement have on the price of corn?
Zip.
Zip? Nothing?
That's really the right answer. And the market didn't react to the announcement. And that was a very rational thing for the market to do, because there's a list of barriers or issues that are going to prevent anything but a marginal rollout of expanded E15 use in the next few years.
And what are those barriers?
Well, first off, a lot of confusion I hear out there. The president did not announce that we now have year-round E15. What he announced was the start of a rulemaking process by the EPA to administratively allow E15 to have an RVP, it's called reed vapor pressure. It's the volatility of gasoline in chemistry and chemical terms. In summer months, when it gets hot, gasoline becomes more volatile and ethanol tends to be more volatile than other petrochemical feedstocks to make gasoline. And so that's why there's this need to have a waiver to the normal volatility specs for gasoline when you add more ethanol. There is no rule yet. Nothing has been released.
Well, the process has begun. The Office of Management and Budget released some information showing the EPA is expected to release a proposed rule to allow year-round E15 sales in February. of next year, 2019, with a final rule scheduled to be issued sometime in May.
Yeah, exactly. So the EPA is going to have to release a preliminary rulemaking. There'll be a comment period, and they will announce a final rulemaking. And then the refining industry, oil refining industry in the United States, has clearly and loudly announced that they are going to litigate whatever rulemaking the EPA comes up with in the next year and challenge it in court. And my personal reading is they probably have a pretty good chance of knocking down whatever the EPA proposes. I'm not a legal expert, but the text that this all relies on in the Clean Air Act seems, a plain reading of it seems pretty clear of it, that it will take a congressional action to allow a year-round RVP waiver.
Okay, but what if big oil loses?
I only listed one of the barriers for E15 moving forward. Let's take your scenario where the court challenge fails. But remember, that's going to take a couple years. So there's going to be legal uncertainty for probably the next sometime between 2 to 3 years about this issue. On top of that, there's the legal uncertainty of liability issues for E15 misfueling. You know, there's a lot of arguments about exactly how many vehicles out there can use E15. The corn ethanol industry says 90%. Of course, the refining industry says it's a lot smaller than that. But whoever's right, there is a significant number of vehicles out there that can't use E15. And there's been no settlement of who's liable legally for any misfueling claims. And so that's a real impediment to investment in E15 infrastructure on the legal side. And then there's also the basic pricing economics that, at least the way I do the analysis, leads me to be skeptical that it would be it's not easy to price E15 in a way that's really attractive to drivers without the incentive provided by high RIN prices, which we don't have at the present time.
There are a lot of acronyms involved in all of this. There's the EPA and USDA, of course, and RFS itself, Renewable Fuel Standard, plus RVP. And Scott just mentioned RIN, R-I-N, the Renewable Identification Number. And Scott, how does that work?
These are the credits that obligated parties under the renewable fuel standards must turn into the EPA to demonstrate that the required number of gallons have been blended with biofuels. And so they're literally pieces, think of them as pieces of paper that represent gallons of biofuels that have been blended into our transportation fuel supply. That's what they are. The unique part of these credits is that they're tradable, and there's a secondary market that where they're bought and sold, and prices are recorded, just like in the forward market and cash market for corn and soybeans. And there's been tremendous volatility in those prices.
And that's where the allegations of the fraud and manipulation of the credits comes in.
Right. There's been because the price of these RIN credits has been so wildly volatile, a lot of people want to then reach the conclusion, well, this market is subject to fraud, it's subject to manipulation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the president had some provisions about preventing non-obligated parties from trading in the RIN market. My research suggests that that's kind of a red herring, that the market certainly probably isn't perfect, but on average, the RIN prices adequately reflect the fundamentals of those in the RIN market. What's really going on is there's wild variation in those fundamentals that are determining the RIN prices.
Did you get all that? It's complicated. Another challenge for year-round E15 is MPGs.
Well, ethanol, on average, contains one-third less energy in a gallon of ethanol than in a petroleum gasoline. So if you go from 10% ethanol blends, and if you bump that up to 15%, you should take an MPG hit of about 1.7%. So you just round it off. You should lose MPG in the neighborhood of 1% to 2% based on standard chemical measures of the BTUs in ethanol versus petroleum gasoline. That point is hotly contested by people in the corn ethanol industry and farmers. But the measurements here are, if you do a really careful study, that MPG decline has to show up because it's just based on basic chemistry.
Scott Irwin, a professor of agricultural economics at the University of Illinois. By the way, Scott's a good one to follow for general agricultural topics. He is Scott Irwin UI on Twitter. Back to you, Big O.
All right. Thank you very much. Steve Alexander checking in this morning with an interesting conversation on E15. And, of course, it's going to take a while for that to show up because that's a summertime program that they have now changed to year-round. So it'll be interesting to see if we get all of the rules put together in time for summer of 2019. And with snow falling this morning, we're probably not looking ahead to summer of 2019. But you know what? It'll be here before you know it. And I'm going to switch the subject from fuel to apples. That's what I'll be talking about when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Jim Baer is the president and CEO of the apple industry here in the United States. And with all the trade situations we have with corn, soybeans, and wheat, apples affected by what's going on geopolitically?
That's true, Orion, and thank you for having me, and thank you for the question. People might be surprised to learn that apples are the same in the same boat as those other commodities. We export about a third of our crop. As you said, that's equivalent to about $1 billion a year, and our top markets are all at risk. We hear people say that NAFTA was a terrible trade deal for agriculture and for apples specifically. NAFTA was the best trade deal in history. We quadrupled our exports to Mexico. We doubled our exports to Canada, and it's been a huge boon to the apple industry. So we're anxious to see the trade disputes get settled. We're anxious to see the steel and aluminum tariffs removed so we can get back to shipping to those locations and doing what agriculture does best, which is shipping high-quality products around the world.
And which countries are the best destination for U.S. apples?
Well, right now, Mexico is number one. For the first time in decades, Canada is not number two. They've slipped to number three because India has come on really fast. And yeah, it's a miracle of modern agriculture that you can ship an apple from the United States halfway around the world to India, and when it arrives, it's not only still great to eat, but it's affordable for the people that live there. So India's imports of U.S. apples have been exploding up until the trade disputes, and China is a new market, which is tremendous because they're buying top quality at premium prices. So we're anxious to keep that market as well.
Japan has been a big buyer of agricultural products. What about apples?
Well, that would be a natural market. Unfortunately, we're not shipping to Japan. They require a fumigation process, which is damaging to the quality of the fruit. So, yes, it should be a natural market for U.S. apple growers, but Japan is not currently a major market, and we'd like to change that. Japan, Taiwan, Korea, we think all should be on the list, and they're not, and we'd like to see that change, too.
And what are the top three producing states in the U.S.?
Well, Washington State dominates. Washington State grows about 60% of the apples in the United States, followed by New York State and Michigan. And like much of agriculture, our efficiency is really improving over the years. We have fewer acres, but far more production. So on an efficiency basis, we're matching our brothers and sisters in the row crops that you might be more familiar with, and our efficiency gains have been tremendous.
And then my most important question, what is happening to the Red Delicious apple?
Well, Orion, for the first time in over half a century, the Red Delicious is no longer the most widely grown apple in the United States. You probably know this history. It was first discovered growing wild in a farmer's field near Winterset, Iowa. Yeah. And it was the apple that changed the world at that time, that iconic red color and that shape that we recognize. But we just announced in August at our annual meeting that the Gala apple has replaced the Red Delicious as the most widely grown apple in the United States. The Red Delicious isn't going away. It's slowly declining, but it will always be an important apple for the export market because it travels well, and it's actually very much desired in export markets, particularly in Asia, where if I came to visit you at the holidays, I would bring you the beautiful Washington Red Delicious apple as a sign of friendship and good health. So that's an important apple for export, but it's no longer the most important apple for domestic consumption.
Thank you for the education. A visit with Jim Baer, President and CEO of the U.S. Apple Commission. We are at 28 minutes after 5 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show. The timing of this activity couldn't have been worse. A week before Thanksgiving, a ground turkey recall linked to deadly salmonella outbreak. Jennie-O Turkey Store sales recall of 91,000 pounds of ground turkey products late Thursday night is the first supplier link to a salmonella outbreak that has sickened 164 people in 35 states and caused one death. A map of the outbreak shows it's sort of rambled all over the regions with double-digit illnesses in California, 13, New York, 12, Minnesota, 17, Illinois, and Texas, 11. And the death happened in California, so that's of concern. But just follow the rules on that recall, and I think you'll be okay. Of course, I'm not a medical doctor, but the situation, as I said, couldn't have come at a worse time for the turkey industry. The good news for the turkey industry, though, is a pair of South Dakota turkeys will make their trip to the nation's capital in the hopes of receiving a presidential pardon and avoiding ending up as a Thanksgiving dinner at the White House. Tourism officials in the bird's hometown of Huron, South Dakota, paraded the turkeys around the city on Wednesday of this week as part of a formal send-off. And although the turkeys have been presented to presidents for about 70 years and have been receiving pardons since 1989, this is the first year South Dakota was chosen to present a gobbler. The 40-pound birds, chosen from a flock of 50 candidates that were raised on a farm north of Huron, South Dakota, by turkey farmer Reuben Waldner. And those birds that do get the pardon, what happens to them? They will go to Virginia Tech University and live out a normal life. All right, we're here, ready to go, and we'll be talking markets. Max Armstrong checking in with his guest from Allendale, based in McHenry, Illinois, in just a couple of minutes. But right now, as always, it's time for Samuelson Says, brought to you by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I am Orion, and this week, a question I've asked several times in the past few months, where is the farm bill?
The folks at Wink Products Company want to help make your life easier with a family of professional strength cleaning products, products that really work. Wink Rust Stain Remover is the number one liquid rust stain remover in the country. This professional strength formula dissolves those ugly rust stains on white sinks and toilet bowls, color fast fabrics and carpets. This little brown bottle has been around for 71 years and it's still number one. To learn more about the full line of Wink products, check us out at WHINK.com.
Well, it seems they do this to us every time they write a farm bill. They get an early start that encourages us to believe they are going to have it finished before the August recess, in plenty of time. And then, as is the case this year, they not only miss the September 30th deadline, but they might also miss the end of the year deadline. We can't let that happen because that would mean we will have to start all over again to write a farm bill next year. We will be doing it with a new Congress, and we may lose much of what we have in the current version that the House and Senate are trying to pass. Now, the big sticking point seems to be, as it is almost every time we write a farm bill, the nutrition program, known as food stamps years ago, now known as SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Most farmers I know have always wondered why food assistance programs should be part of the farm bill and part of the USDA budget. Well, the answer is simple. Leverage. There aren't enough rural votes in the House and Senate to pass a farm bill without support from urban legislators. The president and many Republicans would like to see a work requirement added to be eligible for the food assistance program. Yet other people, many of them urban Democrats, say no, it's not fair to put a job requirement in the bill to receive the food assistance. As I asked on Samuelson Says 3 weeks ago, what is so bad about having to get a job or having a job to be eligible for food assistance? The proposed requirements says you have to be between the ages of 18 and 59 and free of health problems or unusual family problems to qualify for assistance. Jobs are available, as evidenced by the many help wanted signs I see in my community. So, members of Congress, this should not be a sticking point in finishing the farm bill. Let's get this problem resolved so that we can have a farm bill on the president's desk before the end of the year and let producers know what the rules are before the new crop year. Let's get it done. My thoughts on Samuelson Says, a presentation of Tribune Radio Networks at 20 minutes before 6 o'clock. And we'll be checking in with Max Armstrong to talk markets with his guest when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show.
With us in the studio this weekend, Jim McCormick from Allendale to talk about markets for a moment. Jim, we've seen climbing soybean prices, and that's all in anticipation of that key meeting that the president might have. Give us some of the background on that for someone who hasn't been following this closely.
Well, right now, earlier in the year, the beans are trading over $10. The market was optimistic. China, our biggest buyer, had continued to buy our beans, and the trade rhetoric was kind of ratcheting up, but nothing had been hit yet. Memorial Day weekend hit. A lot of people thought we had a trade deal with the Chinese. I think Steve Mnuchin had worked it out. It fell apart at the last minute, and the bean market crashed. Plain and simple, China is our biggest buyer of beans. If they're not buying our beans, we're going to have an oversupply in the United States. And it broke the market hard, broke it down to near $8. Now, recently, we've kind of worked our way back up toward the $9 level as there's been optimism as we build to this G20 meeting that maybe we can get a deal cut and we can get China back buying our beans. Because for the most part, Max, they haven't bought a bean since these tariffs kicked in. So there's a lot of optimism pushing this market up on this. And if they can get a deal done and kind of get a ceasefire and maybe get China buying some beans, I think you'll see a little bit more to this rally. Unfortunately, if it falls apart and we don't get any new deals done and they ratchet up the trade tensions, we're probably going to see the beans slide back down to the lows and potentially even take those lows out.
Haven't there been some beans, some United States beans, that have wound up in some way, shape, or form getting to China, maybe being processed elsewhere into meal and then shipped in?
There has been a little bit of way of China's kind of doing a workaround. Plain and simple, the Argentinians had a lot of beans. They traditionally take their beans, crush it, and then sell the meal. Well, because of the tariff, the Argentinians and the Brazilians, for that matter, have made a lot of money selling beans, about being able to mark them up a little bit just shy of our tariff premium that the Chinese would pay. So what happened was the Argentinians were emptying their bins, selling the beans to the Chinese, in essence, and then refilling their bins with the U.S. beans. So in a way, we are getting some beans probably into China, kind of a backdoor front. But the fact is, we really need to get that direct shipment. The Pacific Northwest is where traditionally a lot of beans go out. A lot of the Dakota beans, the South Dakota beans are produced, are meant to go to the Chinese market. So we're seeing just a horrible cash prices in the Northern Plains because those beans are not they're just sitting on farm, unfortunately, and some of them sitting in bags under snow at this time of year.
There's not another option for those beans where they're going to go. And some are still in the field, I guess, now that I think about it. About 10%, I think, left out there yet in North Dakota as of last weekend, along with about 30% of the corn crop still out there. So the dates for this meeting coming up are when?
Well, the meeting technically starts November 30th is when the G20 meeting is. This is actually a side meeting between between Trump and the Chinese. They haven't, as far as I know, set an official timetable, date, specific hour when they're going to meet, but it should be that November 30th timeframe. So I would look for a little bit of choppy, volatile trade building into it, and then coming out of it, hopefully it gives us a nice Santa Claus rally. I think it's not just going to be the beans, Max. It's going to be affected by it, the hogs. The China's had this huge problem with this African swine flu. Their herd's getting beat up by it, but they're not buying our pork. So if you could get the deal done, I think you kind of get a kind of a lot, rising tides lift all commodities if something would be able to finally be worked out.
Some might say there is pressure on the president to come up with some kind of an agreement, but here we are already on the other side of the election. We know the outcome of that. Some people would argue that this president isn't nearly as prone to political pressure as others. How do you assess that landscape? Is there more pressure on him after the election now? Simply because he has to work with the Democrats in the House.
I think that, I would guess he still has a little bit of pressure. I mean, the fact of the matter is the rural base is his base. Those are who put him into Congress. Those are who voted for the most part, a Republican Congress, as the Republicans extended the Senate, their Senate control. So I think he's going to feel a lot of pressure. I think when you hear this surveys of the farmers, they've hung with him pretty well. They have faith that he's going to get this worked out. I would guess he is going to feel some heat, though, because just talking to my customers, I think they'll be very, very frustrated if something doesn't happen soon, because we're running out of time, plain and simple. The Brazilian harvest is going to be coming online within 30 days, and it's only going to ramp up. You're talking 120 million metric ton crop, a monster crop that we're going to be competing with. And then sooner than later, we've got to start talking about planting the 2019 crop. And cash flows are still very, very tight. So I think the pressure is going to be on them, hopefully. And, maybe that's what we need. We need the farmers to put pressure on the Trump administration to get the deal done on our end of it. Just like the Chinese are feeling pressure due to their stock market being quite weak after the tariffs have taken hold. So, both these gentlemen, I think, are feeling the pressure. And hopefully that pressure will lead to a positive outcome.
Jim, when we get into this period post-Thanksgiving and ahead of Christmas, don't we continue to see many years a little bit of a rally there in the grain market in the early days of December?
In the early days, yes. We tend to get a little bit. The old axiom in the trade seems to be like the bears get Thanksgiving, bulls get Christmas, or vice versa. The markets are a little bit depressed, so hopefully we can get a kind of that seasonal rally. But I truly, Max, think a lot of this is going to hinge on how these trade deals play out. If they would really stumble hard and we're ratcheting up the tariffs, like he's threatening tariff everything across that gets imported from China, I don't see how that could be bullish the market. I think it'll put the market in a very sour mood, unfortunately, going to the end of the year. So let's be optimistic and hope something can get worked out.
World usage of soybeans is going to be a problem for some time to come, is it not? I mean, even if we resolve this current spat with China, aren't we going to continue to have more beans than we need in the world?
Right now, without a weather problem, we are, at this point, between the U.S. and the ramped-up production in South America, we are overproducing, plain and simple. The United States is going to have, right now, its projected carryouts just shy of 1 billion bushels. Think about that. You could probably lose 4 or 5 million acres of beans next year, and your carryout would fall back to maybe 300-400 million bushels, which is still high by historical standards. So, yeah, we've got a problem. We need to kind of back off bean production, which I think we will. I think we'll lose some bean acres right now. And we also need to expand that demand, plain and simple. We got to keep the crushers in the world using the beans, because that's about the only way we're going to get rid of this problem or have a weather problem.
Corn is a different story, isn't it? But with the anticipated increase in corn acres in 2019, will that turn to be a little bit darker story?
Well, right now, the corn situation is kind of a little bit weird. Right now, with what happened last week, the government, China did this big revision of production, a 10-year backtrack, said, oh, wow, our production is a whole lot bigger than what we thought. And essentially, they add about 150 million metric tons to the world carryout. That kind of shocked the market, because the world carryout up until then was projected some of the tightest in 30, 35 years. Well, that kind of spooked the market a little bit, because but China doesn't export corn. So the reality is the world stocks historically are relatively tight. And hopefully that'll give us a rally. But yeah, in the really big picture, Max, let's say we plant 5 million more acres of corn. You're going to add almost a billion bushels to the production. I don't think our demand can handle that. So, you know, producers need to, in the big picture, when they can lock in profits, they need to take advantage of it.
They need to be watching the market closely and recalling, you know, earlier this year, there was that opportunity pre-Memorial Day to put some good prices in, weren't there?
There were. I mean, there's a lot of producers right now that are delivered grain this fall and had some fantastic prices. The market gave them that opportunity. I do think the market is going to give the market, will give the opportunity in the corn. And if we get a trade deal with China, we'll get an opportunity in the beans. But the farmers really need to, you know, cash flows are tight. They need to take advantage of it.
What do you think of all of that grain that is stored out there in non-traditional places this winter? It came home to me just about a week ago, flying at around 2,500 feet from Kansas City to the Quad Cities and going over areas of Missouri and Iowa. I couldn't help but notice those white bags out there that farmers have opted to use to store some grain out there.
Well, you know, the technology is there to hold it. So I don't think quality is going to be a biggest problem. I think the biggest problem we have that we got to be careful about in our industry is the prices are depressed this fall because of the whole tariff. We've had an oversupply of grain. The farmer has essentially stuffed it anywhere he could. And the bags, as you put it, look, you know, just like big old snakes laying out in the fields are where we're holding it. But as we get into the springtime, they got to start moving that product. And they've got to be very cautious about that because essentially we'll be moving our product on farm, off farm, stuff in the field at the same time the Brazilians and the Argentinians are harvesting. And we could essentially put a glut in the market. So the farmers have got to be very careful, I think, and not get too complacent of just holding the beans and trying to forget about it. They need to take advantage of market opportunities because the competition is only going to build into the springtime as South America's harvest ramps up.
This November rally that we saw over the past few days, was that enough to price them out of producers' hands?
You know, I don't think so. As you look at the price of beans, they're back to 9. They're kind of at the high end of the range. I think the producers have sold the beans they want to sell at these levels. I think we can have the 20, 25 cents. I think they'll start breaking free. Same thing for corn. The corn market's down around 365, 375. The farmers really aren't too interested in selling. I think you get it closer to the $4 level basis, the March contract. I think you will start seeing grain break free as they try to start making this movement into the wintertime and try to, you know, keep the pipeline full.
Jim, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Jim McCormick with Allendale Incorporated.
Well, as Max and Jim were talking about soybean and corn sales, indeed, we have been selling some soybeans since last Tuesday. We sold a total of 524,000 tons of soybeans, all to unknown destinations. And we've also had an interesting time in November selling corn. Over 500,000 tons of corn have been sold to Mexico since the 1st of November. So looking at where the markets ended yesterday, and that means where they'll begin on Monday, the soybean futures ended higher yesterday, and much of that because of what Max and Jim were talking about, the discussion that is going to take place at the end of this month between the presidents of China and the United States. And so as we look at the closing prices in the grain market, the December wheat contract ended up 1.25 cents yesterday at 506¾. But December corn was down 2¾ cents at 364¾. And the January soybean contract ended the day up 3¾ cents yesterday at 892¼. An interesting trade in the hog futures at the Mercantile Exchange yesterday. Technical buying that accelerated the gains, lifting several of the deferred month contracts to life of contract highs. One analyst said African swine fever concerns are in the market again. China found an outbreak in Sichuan, which is their largest pork-producing province, and they also found it in a wild boar. It just looks like it's getting worse. The virus has been confirmed in more than 60 locations in 18 provinces over the past 3 months. So that apparently had an impact on the live hog futures yesterday. The December live hog settled at $60.07. February closed at $66.75. Both of those contracts were up the daily $3 limit and above all major moving averages. And trading limits will expand on Monday to $4.50 after the limit up close yesterday. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. And then, of course, traders looking ahead to next week's USDA cattle on feed report. That's expected to show November 1st on feed cattle numbers at up 4.5% compared to a year ago. So those are some of the items that traders will be looking at when we start trade on Monday. And keep in mind, the markets will be closed in observance of Thanksgiving Day, so markets will be closed all day Thursday. And then on Friday, they'll open, but not for a full session. They'll be closing at noon on Friday. Well, as happens every week at this time, we're out of time. And want to thank you for listening. Want to thank Bob Ferguson for doing the engineering that makes it all happen. And again, we look forward to being with you next week to take a look at a holiday trading week.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.